Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Remember the last time you were really stressed about something? Maybe a big project at work, or a speech you had to give, or just rotten traffic on the way into work. If you had butterflies in your stomach, felt your heart racing and your palms sweating, you might also have thought, this cannot be good for me. It's true that in one study, adults who reported they were under significant stress were more likely than their relaxed peers to die in the 8 years that followed the initial interview. But there's a catch. The ones who died were almost exclusively the same ones who believed stress was physiologically harmful. Those who didn't see stress as hazardous were no more at risk than the subjects who were not stressed out. After learning that, my guest decided it was time to take a closer look at the effects of stress, and she has concluded that we might actually benefit if we can learn not to avoid all stress, but to embrace our body's natural responses to challenging situations. Kelly McGonigal is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. Her new book is called The Upside of Stress: Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Kelly, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
You actually spent years of your professional life, like many of your peers, preaching against stress and saying it had really existential hazards. What did you believe then about its harmful effects?
Well, you know, I'd been trained in psychology and medicine that stress is basically the enemy of every aspect of well-being, because I was taught that stress was a toxic state in your body, in your brain, that we really needed to avoid or suppress or reduce or even medicate that toxic state, because if we find ourselves stressed, it's inherently unhealthy. And as you said, you know, this is a belief I think that many people hold, and it turns out that holding that belief may actually amplify the potential harm of being in that state of stress.
So tell us about the day that started you thinking in a different way.
So you mentioned that study that was first published in 2011 that found that how you think about stress might actually influence whether or not stress can kill you. And when I first downloaded that study, I actually downloaded it because I thought it was going to be another study that said stress kills you. And I thought, oh, great, I can add this to my lecture on how toxic stress is. And when I kept reading the article, and I came to that point where they were talking about the interaction effect, that the people who experienced a very stressful year were only more likely to die if they also believed that that stress in their life was harming them. And that the people who had a very stressful year at the beginning of the study and didn't believe that that stress was harmful, they actually were protected. They were the most likely to be alive a decade later. And that finding just completely confounded me, because I had spent over a decade telling people that their stress was harmful. And it made me consider the possibility that the way that we as health professionals talk about stress may actually be contributing to its harm. And, you know, that was really not a good day for me to think about that I might have been contributing to that.
If believing stress is harmful makes it so, what could possibly be going on there? How is it that the same physiological symptoms that make me sick don't affect my neighbor who takes them in stride, or vice versa?
Well, there are a couple of ways to think about this. One is how our mindset towards stress affects our physiology immediately. And the other is how the way we think about stress changes the way we cope with stress. And they're both really interesting. It turns out that when people think about their own physical symptoms of stress in a more positive way, for example, viewing it as energy, it changes everything from the level of inflammation in their body to how much their blood vessels constrict, without necessarily calming them down, that you can actually have a healthy stress response that helps you rise to a challenge. And people who view stress as very harmful and toxic are more likely to have a physiological response that actually is toxic, with higher inflammation and higher blood pressure. And then the other side is that, you know, when we view the state of stress as something we need to avoid or reduce, we're more likely to feel inadequate to the challenges in our lives. We're more likely to say, want to get a drink, rather than tell someone what we're going through. And we're more likely to avoid the situations that would allow us to actually build resources and find some way to transform the situation that we're in. And so I think those are two good ways to think about why our beliefs about stress matter.
Did that study that started you thinking in a different way, did it account for the fact that, you know, people self-report in different ways? Maybe people who said, I have a lot of stress, but it doesn't bother me, weren't under the same kinds of stresses as their peers who had deleterious health effects?
Yeah, we don't actually know that, because the way they measured stress in that study was simply how much stress did you experience in the last year? A little bit, a moderate amount, or a lot of stress? But other studies that have come out since suggest that it's not necessarily the case that the kind of stress matters. So researchers at Yale, for example, looked at whether taking a more positive and accepting view of stress would help people thrive under high levels of work stress, and that seemed to be the case. In my own experience, it seems like, sort of paradoxically, the worse the kind of stress you're going through, the kind of things that I would actually call suffering rather than stress, the more important it is to actually have a trust in your own ability to get through that situation. And part of that trust comes from no longer feeling like every time our heart pounds or every time we feel overwhelmed, it's a sign that we are, you know, basically crumbling in the face of what life is giving us.
Of course, this goes against a lot of what most of us have been hearing for years, and there have been scientific studies suggesting stress is always toxic. Can you give us some context, though, on how some of those studies were conducted and why they may not apply to the kinds of stress most of us experience in everyday life?
Sure. And I do want to start by saying that it is true. There are lots of studies showing that stress can be harmful. And the sort of taking a more positive view of stress is not necessarily negating the fact that in some cases stress is harmful, but it's about balancing that point of view by coming to appreciate some of the benefits of stress and also our own capacity for resilience. And the early studies that made us view sort of all stress as toxic actually weren't even done on humans. They come from the work of Hans Selye, who up in Canada was basically torturing rats and finding out that no matter how you torture them, whatever the technique, they seem to get sick and then they died off. And he called what was happening to the rats stress, and their own reaction to being tortured in various ways, the stress response. That's actually how the term stress got coined in our modern understanding of it. And Hans Selye made this really radical leap from rats to humans, where he claimed that our own experience of illness and death was probably identical to what he observed in his rats, and that physical process of, you know, how their systems would shut down and their immune response would be impaired and eventually they would collapse and die. He thought, well, what I'm doing to them, that's equivalent to what we experience in life as humans. And he actually ended up defining stress as anything that requires us to adapt or change, despite the fact that he didn't have any data on humans. And when you have that definition of stress, that stressful circumstances are anything that requires us to adapt or change, we're basically saying that's life. And if you believe that the consequence of life is to end up like Selye's rats, then yeah, you're going to think stress is always toxic.
Does Selye's work have anything to do with the origins of the phrase rat race?
Oh, you know, that's really interesting. You know, I think a lot of the early psychological research actually was done using rodents. And so I bet it comes out of that same area of behaviorism where psychologists thought it was a lot easier to study rodents than it was to study humans.
Okay, let's talk about what happens in our bodies when we experience emotionally stressful events. What happens physically?
So the first thing to understand is that there's more than one kind of stress response. And most people are familiar with fight or flight. And that's a kind of stress response you can have. It's a kind that we tend to have when we're feeling very threatened. And in that sort of stress response, basically the body and the brain get flooded with energy to try to help you escape or defend yourself. And that's when you might notice your heart pounding, you might start sweating, your senses become very awake. You can literally see more and hear more, and time sometimes seems to slow down, kind of an emergency response. But that's only one way that the body and brain can respond to stress. And there are some other sides of our physical stress response that most people don't understand is happening. One is that, you know, in addition to releasing adrenaline and cortisol, the familiar stress hormones that give us energy, your adrenal glands also release a hormone called DHEA, which is a neurosteroid. And its job is to actually help you recover from stress in a way that makes your brain and your body more resilient and healthier. So, for example, it will help your brain grow new connections after a stressful experience so that the next time you go through it, you actually find it more familiar and easier to handle. And another side of the stress response most folks don't appreciate is that your pituitary gland releases oxytocin, which is sometimes called the love hormone. It's a hormone that makes us want to connect with others. So when you're stressed out, you might find that you want to talk to a loved one, or you want a hug, or you want to pet your dog. And oxytocin also makes us willing to help others. So sometimes when we're stressed out, we feel a need to help other people who are struggling. And that oxytocin can make us really pro-social and give us extra courage when we're feeling overwhelmed. And these are sort of the other sides of the stress response, in addition to that pounding heart that I think we're all familiar with.
The oxytocin thing is fascinating because so many times when we're stressed out, what we seem to think we crave is, you know, time alone where we have nobody asking anything of us. The idea that turning around and helping someone else could actually be beneficial might surprise people.
Yes. And, you know, so that's actually another possible response to stress is the desire to withdraw, right? So there are so many different ways we can respond to stress. There's even a freeze response or a defeat response that would make us feel kind of paralyzed in the face of whatever we're dealing with. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is how do we harness the instincts that actually help us better cope with the kind of stress that we're under? So if you are someone who has a tendency to want to withdraw and retreat under stress, and that's not helpful, you know, how could you actually wake up the instinct to connect under stress, to get the support that you need or to get the benefits of helping others? And I think that that's really what it means to be good at stress, is to go from, you know, some of us feel very stuck in one way of coping with stress, and our physiological stress response can get stuck in sort of one dynamic as well. And when we learn sort of all of the ways that stress is trying to, you know, our body and our brain are trying to help us cope, and we start to see all of the resources that are part of our stress response repertoire, we can actually get better at stress, and that makes stress healthier for us.
Kelly, so many times when people have lived through a real crisis, in the aftermath, they can frame it as incredibly, excruciatingly hard, but this great opportunity for growth. Is there a way to see it as an opportunity for growth, even in the moments when it feels absolutely awful?
Yes. And in fact, we know one way to do that is to actually remember some of the really interesting research on post-traumatic growth, which says that the amount of distress that you go through in the experience or soon after the experience, the more it shatters your beliefs about the world, the more it feels overwhelming, the stronger your emotions, that actually the more likely you are to experience really strong growth down the line, that actually the distress seems to be the engine for whether it's becoming stronger or changing the priorities in your life or deepening your faith. And I think that often when we are experiencing that deep overwhelm or suffering, that we feel like it's a sign that there really is no hope, and also that we aren't adequate to what we're trying to get through. We take it as both a sign of what's fundamentally wrong with our life and what's fundamentally weak about ourselves. And, you know, when I teach these stress mindset interventions, what I try to help people do is think, well, you know, you can feel the suffering and it's going to be awful for a while. But studies show that if, as you're going through that pain and that difficulty, if you're also able to even just once a day think about it as an opportunity to grow, think about the strengths that you're using to cope to get through it, or anything that you can appreciate about yourself and how you're responding, any kind of way that you can link the situation to your values and what you care about, that increases the chance that over time you'll experience more and more of the benefits and the growth.
My guest is health psychologist Kelly McGonigal. She's a lecturer at Stanford University and author of a new book called The Upside of Stress: Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, ask a question, tell a story, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with health psychologist and Stanford University lecturer Kelly McGonigal, author of the new book, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Kelly, reframing stress to focus on its benefits sounds like a great idea. Of course, if it were that easy to control our own minds, most of us would probably forego ever allowing ourselves to feel stressed at all. Talk about ways that we can get into the habit of seeing the stress response as a positive thing.
Sure. You know, when I look at sort of what's the most effective way to change your mind about something, the first thing you need to do is pay attention to how you're already thinking or talking about something and see what effect that actually has on you. So, you know, I often ask people to start paying attention to how they talk about stress in their lives, the kind of things that they say, like, this is too much, or I can't handle this, or this stress is killing me. I need to calm down. I need to get away from this. And to think about how those thoughts or those beliefs actually influence the way that we're able to engage with the challenges in our lives. And often, you know, we find that as soon as we start to label something as stressful, we're looking for a way to escape. We want to turn to comfort food, or we want to give up on a project. And we start to shut down rather than engage in some way that will help us deal with the situation. And when people start to notice that, they often become more willing to try on some of these unusual ways of thinking about stress. And I should say that, you know, this was a hard challenge for me because I'm not naturally optimistic at all. I am naturally both pessimistic and highly anxious, which means my tendency is to run in the other direction from any sign of stress. But I found that there are kind of like three ways to think about stress that you can remember in any moment that help us engage with that stress rather than need to escape or avoid. And one is to view stress as energy, that whatever the symptoms are that you're feeling, even if you don't like them, your stomach is churning, your heart is pounding, you're sweating, that actually is a sign that your brain and body is giving you energy, and you get to decide what to do with that energy. You can try to take steps to change what's stressing you out. You can go for a run and turn that energy into an act of self-care. You can use that energy as a sign that something in your life needs to change and think about how you can make that happen in the future. Or you could do anything you want with that energy, and it's not necessarily a sign that what you need to do is shut it down. That's one example.
There's that stress that we feel in the moment, like say we have to give a speech and we really hate public speaking and people get very nervous. There's also the kinds of chronic stress that come with, say, dealing with a serious illness or, you know, living in poverty. Is it possible to reframe the stress that comes from those things that don't go away after a short period of time?
Yes, and it's not necessarily going to be, oh, yay, this poverty is giving me energy, right? That sounds completely ludicrous. But researchers who study people who are able to really thrive and be resilient and not show the typical stress-related and sort of negative health outcomes we would expect from long-term chronic or severe stress like poverty, they tend to be able to hang on to a couple of beliefs. One is that there's something meaningful about the stress that they're going through, and that there's something that they can do to still have an impact on their own lives. So maybe they can't fix their financial situation, but there's something they are moving towards, or there's some sense of agency or control, like there's something in their life that matters. And basically, both of those beliefs boil down to whether or not you're able to find meaning in your life, sort of independent of what you're going through. And one of my favorite mindset interventions that helps people do this is called values affirmation, where people are asked to think about what is really important to you at the end of the day. What's your biggest value? And people often will say things like family or faith or maybe some sort of virtue like courage or compassion. And people are asked to spend a couple of minutes thinking about how they can choose that value or how that value can support them in what they're going through. And that simple mindset intervention has been shown to help reduce depression in very difficult situations, to improve people's physiological stress responses, to make them healthier. And really, any situation you can think of that we would never choose for ourselves, that sort of mindset shift to be able to see the meaning and to turn your situation into an opportunity to choose your values, to act on your values, that seems to be a very important resource.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Kim in Denton. Hi, Kim.
Hello. I wanted to share my stress my stress incident with you and how I handled it. My son died a little over 2 years ago, and it was very tragic and very sudden. Mm. In the first year, I was so busy managing his estate and being thrown in with all kinds of people, attorneys and people at the bank and so on and so forth, and having to, and he was a musician, so I had to sell his piano and various things. So that first year, I was either with many, many people and home alone because I was grieving so strong. You know, you're crying and you're yelling and you're screaming and you're angry and all kinds of things. So I really was with people all day, and then at night I would just let go. Then the second year, things were settled, and I began to seek people out. I belong to a dog therapy club, and I have two dogs, and so we go now to various institutions and take our therapy dogs. And I've also rejoined a choir that I had not sung with for 2 years. And I know, I can feel I need people. My daughter lives in California. My other son lives in Waco, and I'm here alone in town. So I seek out people. I have lunch with my dog club friends and lunch with people from the choir. And I'm a psychotherapist, so I see clients in the evening. And so that's how I handle stress. I'm beginning to live again.
Well, Kim, I'm so sorry for your loss, but it sounds like you've handled it with just extraordinary grace. Is there anything, Kelly, that you heard there that you want to comment on?
Well, I think, you know, and I'm sorry for your loss, too. I think that the way that you described your experience, it really reflects, you know, how many people experience grief, that there's no way to sort of get through the enormous pain of it. And that grief is often directly tied to how much love that we experience. And in the same way that trying to avoid or reduce stress turns out not to be really helpful, you know, trying to avoid or suppress or reduce grief often seems to make that grief more complex rather than allowing it to take its own course. And when people feel ready to re-engage, to start to look for things that, again, contribute to what we know brings meaning into our lives. In my book, I write about a number of people who are really struggling to deal with the loss of a loved one. And one of the women I write about in the book, Jennifer White, you know, she was struggling years after the suicide of her mother. And she always says that there is absolutely nothing good about her mother's death, nothing good about it. But that in order to basically not completely lose herself, she had to find some way to make something good out of it and out of her life. And I think that that's a really good way to think about, you know, when we talk about embracing stress or embracing grief, that it's not about saying there's anything good in the loss or the suffering, but to acknowledge and celebrate the human capacity to take that suffering and point us in the direction of things that are meaningful, that do help others, because otherwise we would be consumed in that suffering.
What does this suggest to you, Kelly, about the best ways that we can reach out to people we know in our lives who are stressed over grief or, you know, job situations or whatever? How can we help the people we care about cope with their own stress?
Well, the first thing I think that we should do is recognize our own tendency to avoid other people who are struggling. Often when we feel empathic stress or contagious stress, we try to avoid or reduce that just like we try to avoid or reduce our own stress. And we really are not good allies. You know, we may start to avoid people who are going through an illness or have experienced a loss, not just because we don't want to catch their stress, although some people feel that way, but also because we feel like we can't cope with how we feel when we're around them and we sense what they're going through and we sense their pain. And so part of accepting and embracing stress means accepting and acknowledging that we are capable of handling what we feel when we're around other people who are suffering, and that it's okay to feel that empathic distress. And another thing to do is recognize that other people are also adequate to their own experiences, even as you offer to help them, to at the same time be able to see their strength, to be able to to understand that the situation they're going through is part of who they are, not all of who they are. In many ways, being able to take a more, that sort of that bigger perspective on the role that this situation has in their life, and that it doesn't necessarily define them as being weak or someone to be pitied or someone to be avoided. In many ways, that goes a huge way to helping them deal with stress. And that's about your own mindset. It's not about going up to someone who's suffering and say, well, maybe you can find something good in this, which is actually, you know, probably offensive to say to someone who is in pain. So I really think working with your own mindset so that you're better able to be there for people is going to be more helpful than trying to tell them to just, you know, look on the bright side.
A lot of people who have been through great trauma also hate being told how brave they are or how there must be something special about them.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. Because first of all, we all have access to courage, and we have access to courage when we have no choice. And, you know, a lot of the groups that I've worked with, cancer survivors, for example, or trauma survivors, they hate being told how brave they are because their actual experience is often fear. I don't want this. I wish I could in some way escape this. They feel like it separates them from others, that other people are viewing them as somehow unfortunate and unlucky, and that they themselves are completely protected, that, you know, they'll never experience that suffering. And so I think it's, you know, one of the things, the ways that I like to think about courage is that it's actually what comes forward when we're put in a situation that we can't control and wouldn't choose. And that it's actually more helpful to recognize that we all have access to courage, and the context often evokes it in us. That it's wonderful to celebrate courage, but not to use it as a way to imagine that somehow, you know, the person who's going through it is going through it in order to be your inspiration, or that in some way it allows us to pity them rather than connect and understand the real common humanity of what they're going through.
Back to the idea that being under stress, you know, puts this heart-pumping adrenaline in our systems, but it also produces oxytocin, the love hormone, as you called it, that makes us crave physical touch and makes us more empathetic. People who, say, don't live with families or a partner, can that physical touch come from something like a dog or a cat?
Oh, yes. You know, a study came out a few weeks ago that got a lot of attention that found that when you look in a dog's eyes and it looks back at you, both of you experience increases in oxytocin. And I have cats. I try staring in my cat's eyes. I think petting them works better because they don't have the same loving gaze as dogs. And, you know, Kim mentioned that she actually uses dogs as therapy. And in many ways, any time you're caring for someone or something, it can actually produce this biology of this tend and befriend response, which actually gives us more courage, dampens fear, and helps us connect with others. It could be caring for a plant or caring for a garden. It could be, you know, being with animals. And it can even be like when you think that you are in some way caring for something that matters to you, it can even be more abstract than that. In many ways, I think a lot of hobbies that involve using our hands, you know, it's that same kind of We are contributing with our hands. That's very similar to the instinct that leads us to give someone a hug or hold our child.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Joy in Waxahachie. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have some comments on how I have dealt with stress over the last 6 or 7 years. I have dealt with job loss. I have dealt with being in a major car accident. I have had cancer. I have dealt with some pretty nasty custody stuff with an ex-husband. And, you know, I have had to realize that I am not in control, which is a little hard for me because I like to be in control. I have to depend that I know that God is in control. And I have family and friends that I can lean on when I am having a bad day. But I also have to get up every day and think, what can I do today? What, you know, I can't do more than I can do. Some things you have to say no to, and what can I do today to get through the day? And I work for a nonprofit, so that helps a lot in knowing that I'm getting up every day and I'm doing something that's wonderful for my community.
Thank you so much. It sounds like you've had a really tough time, Joy. I appreciate you sharing your story. Kelly, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, what Joy described is something that psychologists call a bigger than self mindset, and it seems like it's really helping Joy get through this. It's the ability to connect to something bigger than yourself, sort of, you know, independent of what the source of stress is. And that could be faith, it could be family, it could be some sort of service or mission or purpose that you're able to give towards in your work or in your community. And when people are able to find any of those, and it sounds like Joy has many of them, but when people are able to find any of those bigger than self connections, it really does create resilience. It helps us find either meaning in our everyday actions or even meaning in what's causing us the source of stress. And I think also what's so interesting about what Joy described is when I talk about being good at stress, I talk about really three strengths: being able to engage, to take actions every day, being able to connect with others, and being able to grow from the experience. And she basically described all of those mindsets, getting up every day. And by the way, it's a stress response that actually allows us to get out of bed in the morning. That's what wakes us up, as a stress response physiologically. And to think, I'm going to get up today and I'm going to do something, right? That makes us good at stress, to think I'm going to find the energy and take action. The ability to connect with others, to stay connected, to help others, and to receive support. And this idea of growing from our experiences, faith can be a big part of that, but so can any way of thinking about the experience from a bigger perspective and being able to find the meaning in it.
What do we know, Kelly, about why some people are more likely to feel great persistent anxiety over minor stressors than others? Is it just about the way they're wired?
Yeah, there's a lot of biology to this. I mean, if you ask my parents, I came out of the womb worrying. I don't think there's anything they did or that life did to make that the case. A lot of people have sensitive or inhibited temperaments that, you know, my husband calls me the early warning detection system, that we're just more likely to think about the things that could go wrong, or we're more likely to be unable to sort of turn our minds off thinking about what needs to get done or what other people are thinking and feeling. And that turns out to be both a strength and a vulnerability. The vulnerability, I think, we're used to thinking about, because most of us who feel anxious don't like how anxiety feels. It's distressing. But it also turns out to be a strength, in that it allows us to engage more fully and be more perceptive. And that's part of embracing stress, to be able to view even that anxiety as a potential strength.
Health psychologist Kelly McGonigal is my guest. We're talking about her book, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open, with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with health psychologist and Stanford lecturer Kelly McGonigal, who's written a book called The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. That's where we hear from a listener who writes, "There is stress and then there is misery. I work at a place where a reorganization dropped staff into new positions. As you can imagine, when everyone is miserable, we seem to continually discuss what makes us miserable. The stress has led to a much higher absentee rate. Nearly half the staff have left since the reorganization." The listener writes, "I have set up some goals for myself outside of work, long-term and short-term, to give me something to look forward to away from the office. But time spent in the office is some days pure misery." Any guidance?
Yes. And, you know, it's so... I think this is actually a really good distinction, because there's good stress that's sort of uniformly good, like, yay, I'm getting married, and I that's a lot of good stress, or I have a new baby, or whatever that kind of good stress is. And then there's sort of mixed stress, where you know, there's some good sides and some bad sides of the situation itself. And then there are situations that really do feel toxic. And, you know, part of what our own response to that toxic situation is to motivate us to change or to leave. And the fact that people are quitting or absent, and, you know, part what they're doing is they're using their stress as a signal to disengage. And in some ways, that's a helpful stress response to have when people have any kind of choice over the matter. I'm actually more interested in what to do when you don't have a choice in the matter, when you can't leave the job, or it's a situation where there's no way to influence it yourself and you just have to survive it rather than change it or transform it. And I think that one of the best ways to try to deal with a situation that is inherently toxic is to find a way to change the conversation about it. So the person who wrote in mentioned that people talk about how miserable they are, but I bet they're not talking about it in a way that actually helps them feel more connected and more inspired. And one of the studies that I write about, or one of the programs I write about in the book, is this program that actually has people who are in a very difficult work situation, people who are physicians and constantly exposed to death and dying and suffering, that the whole intervention was actually to bring them together and have them tell stories about the most stressful and difficult experiences of their work and just listen to one another and try to really, you know, with empathy, understand what the person experienced as they go through this. And that kind of conversation has been shown to reduce burnout. It's been shown to increase people's ability to find some meaning in their work, even when it's going poorly or incredibly difficult. And I feel like that might not necessarily happen in every workplace, but we can change the way that we talk about our own misery with the people in our lives, or we can find someone who's really good at helping us have that kind of conversation. You know, that's when seeking out a counselor, seeking out a therapist or a support group, when that becomes really important, because we need to have conversations about our misery that aren't just about complaining and venting or sort of competing to see who's more stressed out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now to Jonathan in Dallas. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi. Wonderful show so far.
Thanks.
So I have an interesting question for your guest. During the day, I don't feel myself particularly stressing, worrying. I do lead a very active / busy life. But during the evenings, and I'm woken up 3-4 times a night, my physical body shows signs of stress when it comes to just how my body, I guess, deals with it. But I'm not sure how to recognize it during my, how is that something that can be actually recognized and handled so that way I can actually reduce those signs of stress, specifically sleep in this case?
So are you waking up in the middle of the night feeling stressed when you wake up?
No, I just wake constantly. And it was something I went and talked to my doctor about, and he said, it's obviously stress. Wake 3-4 times a night, you're a healthy individual, it's got to be stress.
What do you think, Kelly?
It could be stress. I mean, I think, first of all, there's a tendency in medicine and psychology to blame everything on stress. It could also be sleep apnea or something else, who knows? But I'm not a physician. So it could be stress. And if it is stress, here's how I might think about that. So when people wake up in the middle of the night from stress, or they're grinding their teeth in their sleep at night, often that's part of the recovery process of stress. That's sort of part of any stress response that you have during the day. There's going to be a lingering physiological and cognitive process where you're trying to make sense of the experience, you're trying to learn from the experience, and your body is trying to recover from the experience. And if we don't find a way to do that during the day, it might happen at night in a way that's not as healthy or helpful for us. And so, you know, I would encourage Jonathan to think about maybe creating some kind of ritual or routine that would facilitate stress recovery before you go to sleep, whether it's something like journaling or making a list of the things that are on your mind before you go to sleep, whether it's something like physical exercise a few hours before you go to sleep if that's not currently part of your routine, whether it's turning off all your devices for a certain period of time before you go to sleep and doing something that feels restorative, you know, whether it's spending time with loved ones or some other activity that is sort of different than what you're spending your regular day doing. I think any kind of ritual you can create that is consistent with the process of stress recovery is going to be really helpful. In fact, one of the people I talked to in my book designed an intervention for police officers that basically was all about how to speed up the recovery process, because one of the common outcomes of being someone who's, you know, on the police force for a full shift is it's very hard to shift out of that state, and they're very likely to experience insomnia and other things like that. And so he recommended, you know, basically you need to do an intense workout. You need to do something that connects to a positive mindset, you know, whether it's gratitude or prayer or thinking about your kids in a nice way. And you need to do something that's a little bit relaxing or unwinding. And, you know, you only need to do them for a few minutes, but to get that all in when you're experiencing very high levels of stress during the day. So that's one thing I might recommend. And also not to, you know, necessarily assume that that sort of your life is toxic because you're experiencing insomnia. I think that that automatic assumption is not always going to lead us in the best direction.
So, Kelly, it sounds like a lot of people benefit from being with other people when they're stressed or when they're experiencing these feelings that things are going badly. And yet, you know, some of us, despite our best intentions, become very difficult to be around when we're stressed. What do we do in those situations where we realize that our level of stress is actually interfering with the health of our relationships, but we don't feel entirely in control of our behavior?
Well, you know, it is hard to be in control of our emotional reactions. I think, you know, one thing that I've found helpful is to start to recognize those as certain ways of responding to stress, that if you become cranky or irritable, or maybe you criticize others, you enjoy sort of picking fights when you're stressed out, that's part of the fight response. If you're someone who withdraws, who doesn't want to talk, who tells people to leave you alone, and you become sort of hard to be around in that way, that's part of the flight response. And that I think it's actually really helpful to recognize these are all natural responses to stress. There's nothing sort of broken about them. It doesn't mean that you're screwed up. But when you recognize them in that way, it actually gives you a little bit more freedom. So first of all, you can take it less seriously. So if I notice that I'm being particularly difficult, you know, with my family, I can actually recognize that, and it gives me some space to back away a little bit and not get so stuck in my head to whatever the story is about why I'm so upset, you know, and that makes me so difficult. And then I can also think, is there another way, another sort of coping strategy that is part of my instinct, my stress response repertoire that would be more helpful in this moment? And that can make it easier to shift.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mary in Southlake. Mary, will you turn off your radio, please?
I'm sorry?
Turn off your radio. Hi.
Oh, I sure did.
Okay. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. My name is Mary, and I'm calling from Southlake. And I got a 22-year-old son, and this past year has been extremely difficult on both of us, but especially him. He has just experienced just extreme pain of flare-ups, and particularly in his back. And this is a kid whose whole life was extremely healthy. You know, he's a UNT student. He works really hard. You know, he's still going to school, managing through all this pain, and he's still working. And, you know, like I said, after seven doctors, we still have a few more to go. He's had four MRIs, brain scans. And he went from 182 pounds to 160 in 1 year. He was completely buff, and he's even kind of lost a little muscle mass. So the issue, you know, we're kind of having is just keeping him encouraged. And, you know, just that pain is just so stressful. It's depressing, and especially, you know, at his age and going from that to this, you know, how can you think he can handle this?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really perfect example of the kind of stress that often ends up being harmful, but doesn't necessarily need to be only harmful. It's, you know, when we think about sort of what's the most harmful kind of stress and response to stress, it's what psychologists call a defeat response, where you no longer feel like anything that you do has any influence on your life or your well-being. There's nothing you can do to change things. You see no meaning in the source of your stress or suffering. There's nothing intrinsically meaningful about it. You don't see any way to turn it into something meaningful. And when it feels like it isolates you from others. And pain and other health crises are a perfect example of a situation that might lead to all of those feelings or beliefs. And that's when you start to fall into things like depression or burnout. And so I think that, you know, when we're trying to help people who are in that sort of situation, some of the best research on interventions that help people not end up completely defeated and depressed are ones that focus on common humanity and helping others. And there are a lot of studies that look at taking people who are dealing with chronic pain or unexplained pain or chronic illness And for example, turning them into peer supporters for other people who are also in pain and showing that that has a bigger effect on their own depression, emotional well-being, and even physical abilities than any other way that people try to help them. Somehow turning them into a helper is radically transformative of their experience because suddenly it's no longer without any meaning, without anything you can do, and completely isolating from others. And, you know, it's tricky to know how to help create that situation for someone. But I think that anything you can do that addresses those three things that make it so toxic, there's nothing I can do, I'm the only one suffering in this way, and there's no way to find any meaning in my experience, in your conversations with him or anyone who's going through this type of situation, anything you can do that challenges those beliefs, even in sometimes very small ways, there's one thing you can do today, or there's one way to think about the strength that you brought to this situation, or there are other people who are struggling in a similar way, that those are the things that become life rafts.
I think we have time to take one more quick call here from David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if the guest has any guidance for helping someone who's been under such stress for so long that they've become loyal to it and defensive of it.
Like it's their identity? Is that what, sort of?
Yeah, and if you try to talk them out of, you know, it's not so bad, they defend their emotional response to being so stressed, even though you can see that it's clearly illogical for why they're being so stressed out.
What do you think, Kelly?
I'd love to hear a little more about that. So is it that they, like, are stress junkies and they love being stressed and they love to complain about how stressed they are? Or is it that you think they're handling their stress in a way that actually is harmful to them?
No, I think that she's just become depressed about situations, job stress, you know, not having a lot of money to live through life. Children's moved out and, you know, she lives alone now, so she just kind of feels a little depressed about that. And when you suggest things to do to kind of get out of the house and you know, live life, she just kind of defends that, well, no, I just don't have the skills to do that, or I just don't know what to do. I don't know how to drive there, those types of things.
Yeah, so it's really hard to change someone else's relationship to stress. And that's funny for me to say as someone who just wrote a book trying to change everyone's relationship to stress. But I feel like in those situations, often people feel like your attempt to change the way they're dealing with their stress is really like a powerful criticism of them. And it actually can be more debilitating than helpful. People often shut down when you try to help them. It can feel like an attack or it can feel in some way invasive. And so, you know, I think one of the best things that we can do is work on our own presence when we're around people we wish we could help but don't really seem receptive to our help. That is, how can we interact with them in a way that is actually radically accepting of whatever it is they're doing? That in the same way that we wish they could somehow embrace their own stress, how can we embrace the reality of interacting with them, knowing that they don't necessarily want to be helped in a certain way, that they are depressed and that depression is real and that's their experience? How can you go into an interaction with them, just sort of breathe with that, know that you can't fix or change their emotional reaction, and focus on what you yourself can do to still want to connect with them and want to support them without being able to control them? And this is really, you know, I said earlier, you can't go in and tell someone to change the way they think about stress. But when you change the way you relate to their stress, that can actually have a transformative influence on them.
Kelly McGonigal is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. Her new book is called The Upside of Stress: Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Kelly, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Connect. The show is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.